Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 49. I'm your host, Strategic Analysis Australia's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm joined by SAA's Head of Research, Dr. Marcus Hellyer.
Hello, Michael, and hello to all of our listeners.
Well, this is episode 49. I was hoping it was episode 50, but we haven't reached that millstone yet.
That millstone? millstone or milestone?
We're just back from some a joint deployment up to the Hunter Valley. Mm-hmm. So risky to have us both deployed to the same location, but we've pulled it off and we're safely
Well,
home.
We did come back separately, so we did mitigate the risk on the return trip. And we did a live show. Unfortunately, we can't post it, but that would have made this one 50 if we'd been able to post that. But
Next time. That would have been a milestone.
Next time could be a way off, though, since I'm about to disappear bird watching in the outback in the Northern Territory, volunteering with the Australian Wildlife Conservancy. So I'll be away for 4 weeks.
Well, you're going to Northern Australia, and I really think this does complete your reconnaissance mission. So first, you went north to Alaska to look at the Indo-Pacific from the northern perspective, very valuable. Then the Samoan for that South Pacific look, and maybe across to Midway, Guam, think about island campaigns, very valuable. And now the Australian perspective in the north. And hopefully you'll see the Port of Darwin. I don't know if they're handling any of the equipment.
Well, I might fly over it.
So really, you will have walked the ground and looked at the oceans from those different perspectives.
Well, yes, I'm not sure how much I'll learn about Australia's strategic outlook sitting in a former cattle station 6 hours from Katherine, but you never know.
Former cattle station, so that's interesting, isn't it? Because it used to have big items, cows there, and you're going there to see birds, which are in fact the small, the smart and the many.
Well, hopefully there will be more of them. They will be the many as the property is rehabilitated now. But I will just say, you are being slightly flippant there, Michael, but when I was up in Alaska and I was in this very remote indigenous village called Kaktovik, the only piece there of sort of federal government infrastructure was a radar station on the edge of the village, sort of looking north, looking over the pole, essentially there to detect Ruski missiles coming over
Russian ballistic missiles.
So, and it's still there, built during the Cold War, still there. I think it's pretty much automated now, but that infrastructure is still there.
So they've taken jobs from the local Inuit community because for generations they had an Inuit radar watch person, but now it's automated.
I'm not sure they did have Inuit radar watch people.
Well, so before you go, I think it'd be good to just catch up on where the Ukraine war and negotiations have got to and think a little bit about the implications out of the recent meetings and negotiations and decisions for America as a partner, not just of Europe and Ukraine, but for us. And in that, think about the foreshadowed US Homeland Defense-focused national defense strategy that the Pentagon is likely to release in September and October, what that means for AUKUS. So we had the chance to have peace in Ukraine, peace in our time. It didn't happen.
No, it didn't happen. I mean, nobody's really surprised about that. Maybe Donald Trump is surprised about that since he seems to think it can make it happen. But there's a couple of problems with the Donald Trump approach to peace in Ukraine from my perspective. The first one is that ultimately Donald Trump doesn't give a shit about Ukraine, right? So it's very hard for the Ukrainians or the Western Europeans who do give a shit because they actually want a just outcome, but they also want an outcome that leaves a strong, robust Ukraine as a kind of buffer between them and the Russians.
Well, I think you saw some of this in the lead-up, didn't you? Because Donald Trump was floating the land deal that Putin was apparently suggested to his envoy, Witkoff, who seems to have varied recollections of what Putin and other officials said to him. But a consistent theme was, hey, if you just give up the Donbass, maybe we can make this all go away, including you. But it was like there's a deal to be had. And the details about what that did to Ukraine didn't seem that important to Donald Trump. So the Europeans and Zelensky, their whole effort in flying to Washington and talking incessantly with Trump as much as they could was to stop him doing a bad deal. Because I think you're right, Trump, he wants a deal. Now, that might be peace if it was a good deal, but he basically just wants a deal.
He wants a deal that he can call peace because because he thinks if he brings peace, I'm doing air quotes here, Michael,
for the benefits of
our listeners. He brings peace and he wins the Nobel Peace Prize and he can shove it up Obama because Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize. Admittedly, not really for doing anything in particular. Donald Trump can say he got a real Nobel Peace Prize. The problem with that is that peace without justice is not truly peace. And so the wise people on the Nobel Peace Prize Committee are not going to give it to Donald Trump for selling out Ukraine. So even if he does get a, quote, air quote, deal, he's not going to win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, your point about does he actually care about Ukraine, and I'd extend that to Europe. I think his primary view is, well, look, Europe should be looking after itself. You know, we've been looking after them for too long. That's why I beat them up about increasing their defense spending. And if that's his attitude to bigger Europe, then it's certainly his attitude to Ukraine. And if you remember, Ukraine played into all the Hunter Biden laptop stuff and all of the was the election stolen stuff. So there's personal history there too that makes me doubt that Trump really does have Ukraine's interests at heart.
Well, and Ukraine currently is sort of the fly in the ointment, stopping Donald Trump getting back into bed with Vladimir Putin, getting the US-Russia thing back on the rails again, and them doing their great man approach to history, setting up their spheres of influence. And so it's just making that really
it's getting
awkward.
In the way.
It's really awkward.
But there was a narrative set around the meeting, around the course of the war, and it was accentuated in the days before the meeting because Russian forces made some small breakthroughs in contested areas with small numbers of troops, but it looked like they'd broken the front lines. And that was all playing into this narrative of Russia is winning this war, Ukraine is losing this. But if you just zoom out a little bit, if Russia's winning the war, they're doing worse than King Pyrrhus. They can't afford to win a war like this.
Well, this is one of the weird things about the Donald Trump approach, is that it swings, the pendulum swings from the one hand saying, Zelensky, you're losing. Go back to that horrible meeting. You got no guards. Yeah. You know, just give up. And then he turns to Putin and he's going, you gotta end this. I want a ceasefire.
Yep.
You know, sort of telling Putin he's got no cards and you need a ceasefire to save yourself. So who the hell knows what is really going on there? I don't think Trump really knows what's going on there. But yes, that narrative, when Trump is trying to put pressure on Zelensky and all of the courtiers around Trump want to put pressure on Zelensky, they adopt the you guys are losing narrative. You guys are losing. But then when you actually drill in and you look at some of the analysis done by people who actually pay attention to this, Zelensky, the Ukrainians may have lost a bit of territory. But if they keep losing territory at this rate, it will take 4 years, according to the UK Defence Agency, just for them to lose the entire Donbass. We're not talking 4 years to lose all of Ukraine, 4 years just to lose the rest of the Donbass. So,
yes,
you know, they are not on the verge of collapse.
Well, and the cost of Russia conquering that small additional part of Ukrainian territory, it's about 1,000 people a day. And increasingly...
Not that Putin cares.
No, but one thing he might care about is increasingly the Ukrainians are disabling and damaging the Russian oil economy. So oil pipelines, refineries, and their transport system. And that is hurting. It's hurting enough that Viktor Orban, the leader of Hungary, complained to Donald Trump about Zelensky damaging Russian oil refineries because Hungary is not getting its Russian oil.
So, and by the way, Michael, how is Ukraine doing that? How is a small to mid-size economy conducting strategic strike against the core infrastructure of another power at ranges, not just in the hundreds of kilometres, but in the thousands of kilometres. How are they doing that, Michael?
Well, they're not doing it with American weapons because it's also come out since the Alaska meeting that the Pentagon hasn't been allowing the Ukrainians to use ATACMS, the US long-range missile to strike behind Russian lines. And it also hasn't been allowing the use of US targeting information that the UK Storm Shadow missile uses. So the Ukrainians have been using their own weapons and they're increasingly...
What?
Yes.
Surely you're not saying a small to medium-sized economy can develop long-range strike weapons itself or with, you know, some IP input from other countries, but they can largely do...
They have
these guys, it. Haven't they realised that you can only crawl? Why are these idiots running, Michael?
One thing Australia can do for the Ukrainians now that we've got the embassy is we can send the head of our GUIO enterprise to Ukraine.
I thought we wanted the Ukrainians to win.
To explain the fundamental mistakes they're making, because they aren't crawling. They have built 6 kinds of indigenous missiles. They've just announced a new one called the Flamingo, a 3,000-mile range cruise missile.
And a very attractive pink, I believe.
Yes, a pink nose cone on the ones they've shown to the press because it's a majority female engineering outfit that is producing this. But a turbofan-powered cruise missile, and there's the Neptune one that they used with the attack on the Moskva earlier. 6 kinds of indigenous missiles, plus, of course, their long-range drone strike system.
Well, these missiles cannot work if they've been made by women, Michael. I mean, Pete Hegseth has told us that, you know, women should stay in the house. They certainly shouldn't vote. Are we seriously saying that female engineers can design missiles?
I think we are. But the speed of their development of their indigenous weapon systems is reducing the power that America has over Ukrainian decision making. And then there's the point you've made about it's not just the Ukrainians developing their own defense industry and capabilities, but the Europeans are stepping in a big way behind them now.
Yeah, and it's sort of interesting. We've seen Trump and co. celebrating these trade deals that they've achieved where these other countries are going to make billions and billions of dollars available to the US, i.e. Donald Trump, to be able to invest at will in the US. Now, putting aside the issue there of crony capitalism and the possibility of construction.
You mean ethics?
Yes, yes, but yeah. Donald Trump put them aside years ago. They seem to think that this is a good thing.
Who thinks it's a good thing?
Well, Besant.
Well, the Treasury Secretary. Well, he gave that amazing interview, didn't he, where he was on Fox News, I think, and he was being asked, so this deal you've done with Japan where they're going to invest $500 billion into American industry and the American economy, have you run that by the Ways and Means Committee of Congress? And Besant pretty much laughed at him and said, well, don't need to because we're using the Japanese money. Yes. We're not using American money.
Well, this is their money. But it is this kind of, you know, we've made parallels before between the administration and sort of the mafia. And it is this view which the mafia have, which is everybody's money is ours.
It's their money, yeah.
Everybody's money is our money. Yeah. And so Scott Besson is essentially saying everybody's money is ours because we sort of gave it to them in the first place when we bought their stuff.
We consumed when
they sold us stuff that we voluntarily bought, they've now got our money. Yeah. So that's sort of the view of the administration.
I tried that out, actually. I went to Costco earlier in the week and I went to them. And I said, you owe me $5,422. And they said, what are you talking about? I said, well, I've allowed you to sell me that amount of stuff over the last 6 months. So you owe me. And what I want you to do is buy my son a motorbike.
How many people are you feeding, Michael?
Well, I bought some expensive stuff. I got a couple of watches, a couple of laptops. But my point is I did them the favour of buying that from them. They now owe me.
Yeah. So I think the administration is thinking the Europeans, as they step up their defence spending, you know, they've agreed to go to 3.5% on defence spending and this sort of fuzzy additional 1.5% on resilience and infrastructure. Mm-hmm. They're thinking, oh, that's all going to buy US weapons. So that money will be ours. But I think the Europeans, while they might say nudge, nudge, wink, wink, yeah, we'll buy some US stuff, they're going, never in your wildest dreams. We do not want to make ourselves even more dependent on the US. They are doing what we, Australia, still refuse to do, which is to invest in our own defence industry.
Well, I think this is important because the narrative around the Russia-Ukraine war is America is the essential partner, but it is playing itself out. It is losing cards.
Yes, actually the US is losing more and more leverage over its partners and allies as it forces them to be more self-reliant and more resilient. The US is losing leverage.
And that's the lesson with the Europeans. They are over-dependent on American military power and technology, but as they increase their spending, one of their goals is to reduce their dependency on American military power and technology.
But that is the lesson that we in this country seem to be unable to learn. I mean, constantly constantly I hear former politicians, former ambassadors, former senior military people, senior public servants basically saying, look, there's no time to walk away from the alliance. We need to be closer than ever before.
We need to get closer and
closer
deeper
than ever before. Yeah. This is no time to, think about a strategic plan B. Oh, and by the way, if you give my consultancy or lobbying firm a shitload of money, I'll open some doors in Washington for you
to get in deeper. Yeah. But I suppose I'm not saying we should walk away from the alliance, but I'm saying we have a less reliable America. And if you look at the precedent of what others are doing, particularly, both Ukraine and the rest of Europe, they are seeing a less reliable America, and they are at least mitigating and reducing their dependency. That's a very rational choice, and it's one we should be making.
It is a rational choice, and it's not one that radical Noam Chomskyan lefties like me are banging on about. This is actually the US's stated position. So we know from the US, to the extent you know anything about what the Trump administration is doing, they've made it very clear that their security policies are local.
Well,
America first.
They're becoming more local. And America first in the land of the Pentagon will mean a new national defense strategy. And apparently that's going to come out September, October this year, so soon, while you're watching various broad-throated finches gamble about in the Northern Territory.
The Gouldian finch is the one I'm really after, Michael.
Right.
I'll send you a photo.
A Gouldian finch, is that it's got a knotted throat?
No, Gould, not the Gouldian finch.
Gould.
I'm not going to chop it in half. Named after John Gould, famous bird illustrator and his wife.
Oh.
Elizabeth, I think, did most of the illustrations, but the husband, as always, is the one who got all the credit. But 19th century bird scientists, yes.
But the US homeland defense focus is going to flavor this national defense strategy. It will have the first priority, apparently, being drafted by somebody, the name is getting familiar, Elbridge Colby.
He's a busy man. He's doing a lot of reviews. He's a very busy man.
And already the Pentagon's interim national defense strategy has a homeland focus. And you can see what that means.
What does it mean, Michael? Tell me what you think some of the pillars is a word we've been using a lot recently. What are the pillars that we've seen of this strategy?
Well, both ICE, their Immigration Customs Enforcement outfit, and the National Guard, and in fact increasingly forces like the Marines, are being used to secure the border, but they're also being deployed domestically. So we've seen, for example, the National Guard with Marines deployed to Los Angeles, at first unarmed and then armed. We've just seen the same pattern repeating itself in Washington, D.C. National Guard deployed there and then being given arms by the Pentagon. And now further plans about deploying them to Chicago. So internal deployments of these formerly outwardly focused forces.
Democrat hotbeds. So what we are seeing is the Trump administration deploying the organs of state against political enemies.
Well, yeah. to show that their political opposition is failing to deliver law and order. That's the narrative domestically.
It is the narrative. Yeah. Of course, as every single piece of data will say, crime rates are falling dramatically.
Across the
whole of the US and continue to fall. But that spoils what is essentially, in my view, a form of Gleichschaltung. It is what we see when all authoritarian regimes come to power. The first thing they do is essentially co-opt all organs of power, police, military, mm-hmm. all the organs of state, and then you make sure that you eliminate any independent voices, any independent authority, and you continue to create crisis after crisis. So authoritarian states function on a narrative of crisis. So again,
crisis in Washington, yep. Now crisis in Chicago. I think this is all, whether you see a historical precedent like the one you're talking about or just its presidential authority, which is one man rule. Back to the Treasury Secretary Bessent talking about Japan investing $500 billion in the American economy. Who was going to decide where those investments were made and in what?
Donald Trump.
It wasn't the administration, it was the president himself. Mm. So a centralization of authority, but with a domestic focus. And then other things I think we'll see reflected in the homeland defense focus to the national defense strategy are the Golden Dome, that $175 billion US dollars to be spent by 2028 on an extravagant space and air and missile defense system. That is actually going to attract priority and money. So it's going to take funding away from other things.
And it won't be $175 billion. by the way.
Very hard to get that amount of money out the door in that time. But it's a reordering of
priorities. Well, it's just the tip of the iceberg in terms... I mean, you look at similar programs involving space and missiles and new technologies. $175 billion will not get you anything near...
Well, I think there's two points. Coverage. One, it will be hard to spend that amount of money by 2028. But if you actually want a continental air and missile defense system that's for drones and missiles and space-based systems, you're not going to get it for $175 billion.
Yes, but to get back to your initial point, when you look at the articulated priorities of the Trump administration, they are not about protecting allies.
Well, in fact, out of this, you get homeland security as priority number one for the Pentagon, not for the whole security set of organs in America, but for the Pentagon. And then you get the Indo-Pacific and the Middle East as following priorities. And that strikes right at the heart of what the Australia-US alliance is about, because if America's new top priority is homeland defense, that's not extended deterrence. That's not alliance infrastructure. That's America first in a very narrow sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you raise extended deterrence. We haven't sort of spoken about it much in this forum, but to me, the sort of psychological underpinnings of extended deterrence is making your adversary believe that Sydney is as important to you
as New York,
Los Angeles.
I see where you're going with this.
Now, is that Donald Trump's view?
Are you suggesting that perhaps to really shore up the alliance, we should allow the deployment of the U.S. National Guard and Marine Corps to fix the hotbed of crime that is Sydney?
There's been gangland shootings in...
In Melbourne.
And Sydney. Melbourne and Sydney. Forest Lodge Hotel. I used to go there as a student. You know, Sydney is overrun.
So if we want confidence...
By gangland crime.
If we want confidence in the alliance and extended deterrence, we should open the door to National Guard and Marine Corps deployments for law enforcement.
What are the Marine Corps doing swanning around Darwin?
Actually, a guy...
Deploy them on the streets.
Maybe National Cabinet should have an emergency meeting to prioritise the list of urban centres where we will ask Donald Trump to deploy the National Guard or Marine Corps.
Let's bring things back a bit, Michael. I think we are all pulling all of this stuff together. It does get back to that issue of the US is unpredictable under Donald Trump. Their stated priorities are quite different from where we've been for the last 7 years.
And they're becoming more narrowly self-focused. You know,
and we're not just inventing that. This is stated by themselves.
Yep.
When you look at Donald Trump's so-called negotiations over Ukraine, they are not about supporting partners in Europe. It is certainly not supporting the victim of a completely unprovoked invasion.
It's not reinforcing the security architecture in Europe and deterring Putin and sending signals to China about the strength of collective deterrence.
But people in Europe are doing something about this. Yes, of course, the Europeans, we had this poor old Keir Starmer. I mean, you must be going, hey, why did I get elected at this time?
You don't get to choose your moment in leadership, Marcus.
But I had to go up to Scotland to Donald Trump's manor house there and suck up to Donald Trump in the United Kingdom. I've just had to round up Macron,
Ursula von der Leyen,
even Maloney. So whoever everyone was thinking, okay, she's a right winger, she's going to be a bit Trumpian. Yeah. She actually went with the Gang of Seven or however
she
many
did,
it was
NATO
to the White House and sat like naughty school children in front of Donald Trump to kind of say, back off, Zelensky.
Yeah, don't beat up my friend.
Don't beat him up again.
Yeah.
Basically, they all went there to try and dissuade Donald Trump from selling out.
To stop bad things happening.
Ukraine.
They weren't there to make good things happen, I don't think. They were there to stop bad things happening.
But when Maloney, who basically is a centre-right kind of populist, is essentially working with Keir Starmer to push back on Donald Trump, you are actually seeing the Europeans going, holy shit, we need to support Ukraine, because if Ukraine collapses, there's nothing between us and Putin.
That's right. Their biggest deterrent force for European security against Russia is Ukraine.
Is Ukraine.
And they know that.
Yeah.
So that narrative about a less reliable America seems to be very obvious in many other capitals,
but
it's not obvious is here in Canberra.
In Canberra. No, not here in Canberra.
So another couple of little straws before we finish. The AUKUS review. So yes. when Elbridge Colby isn't making decisions about whether Ukraine can use American missiles to do long-range strikes into Russia.
And writing national security strategy.
And when he's not homeland-focusing the Pentagon, he's still meant to be doing the AUKUS review.
Mm.
There aren't many whispers coming out of that, and that's probably because he's got so many other jobs he's doing. But one is, as America looks at the fact that since AUKUS, its submarine deliveries have delayed on average by 3 years.
By 3 years,
not accelerated.
Again, we didn't invent that. That's just in the US budget documentation.
America won't have any more submarines than they expected in 2032 when they have to hand them over. In fact, these delays to US submarine deliveries means America will have less submarines in 2032.
I think it's fewer, Michael, fewer.
Fewer, so thank you. Fewer submarines than it expected to have when it signed up to AUKUS, which means it's getting harder to give Australia submarines at that time. One credible outcome could be AUKUS is intact but delayed, which is like every other major program in defence history, by the way.
Yes. This is one of those risks that we've spoken about. So, if we go and look at mega projects, and of course, AUKUS is a giga project, it is a conglomeration of mega projects. Inevitably, they are delayed.
Yes.
Inevitably, they are over budget, and inevitably, they under deliver in terms of benefit.
I'm going to say it, Flivberg.
Flivberg! Flivberg! Ah. What a guy.
The mega project guy.
But
if it is delayed, is there a couple of extra straws about the increasing fragility of things like the Collins submarine from just the crewing side of things?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of focus on the Collins life of type extension, the so-called LOAT. Mm. And one of the things we've seen is that the content of the LOAT, the scope, has sort of been getting progressively whittled back.
It's a load light.
It's a load light. And again, defence is holding its cards very close to its chest on what is actually going to be in the load. But
they don't have the cards.
No, Zelensky's the one who doesn't have the cards.
Okay, sorry. Yeah.
So the load is probably going to be lighter, so which means Collins will not be as capable. But there's also the soft factors, not just the capability of the submarine itself. So, one of the big questions around the transition from Collins to SSN fleets is how do we go from 750, 800 submariners to 3,000 submariners? Yep. How do you nuclearize your workforce while you keep Collins going? And that has always been a really big question. How do you grow the force? How do you train your nuclear workforce
while keeping Collins going?
Yeah. Well, so apparently, and What has occurred is we now have more submariners going through the nuclear training pipeline than through the traditional Collins pipeline, which sort of raises that fundamental question of if it was really hard to sustain the Collins workforce when all of the submariners were Collins submariners, how do you do it when people are being siphoned off?
Yeah, so the tap of recruits going into the Collins training pipeline is already being turned down on its way to off. And the problem with the delay in Virginia's turning up is actually your crewing model might be breaking on Collins and you'd have no remaining room on the rubber band to stretch.
So it's a big worry because it does get back to that point of we're facing a risk we may have no submarine capability at all other than a sort of quasi-borrowed one. So the Surf West Submarine Rotation Force West with some US submarines kind of noodling around off Western Australia. So I'm very concerned. But I'm not the only one because, we've had a recent experience where we were talking to a lot of people and I couldn't find anybody who thought that AUKUS Pillar 1 was going to happen on schedule.
There are only about 300 people that you asked and one of them thought that the first Virginia was going to be handed over on time.
But the remaining weren't.
And it turned out that one person, which wasn't me, by the way, thought that it would only be handed over on time as a symbolic gesture that would hide delays to the broader program.
Mm. And I was talking to somebody who came out of the UK's SSN program.
Yeah.
And I shared my views, which I've shared on in this podcast. Pretty much they agreed with everything we said. So if you want to do nuclear capabilities on 2% of GDP or 2 and a bit percent of GDP, you run down all of your other capabilities, you have a hollow force, and you don't actually do the nuclear capabilities very well. Though all of those issues about standing up nuclear capability from scratch is incredibly difficult, particularly when you don't have a broader civil nuclear workforce. So
to draw skills from.
So this person who has very deep experience in the UK system is looking at the Australian system going, you know, it ain't happening on the schedule you think.
And you don't have the money and you're not doing what you need to in the time. That was their summary, really, wasn't it? The other interesting thing about that UK perspective, and it was from a very informed person who's spent their career working in that nuclear enterprise industry, was the amount of trouble in the UK nuclear and ship and submarine building sector. That all the words we hear from UK ministers, like when they came out for Orkmin, he was scathingly sceptical. He said there's such a large gap between these high-flown words and the reality of UK industrial production in the defence sector.
Yes, we've always said there's kind of a point of no return with AUKUS in that transition. At a certain point, you kind of burned your bridges behind you. You can't go back to Collins. You're so committed. Now, I've written stuff saying, I think by sort of 2036, maybe sometime after, let's assume we do by some miracle get the Virginias on schedule. Let's say you get the second one around 2034, 35. The next one is meant to be coming around 2037, 38, something like that. I think at that point, by the time you got the second one, you just have to turn off the Collins capability because you have such demands on uniformed workforce, such competing demands on industrial workforce, and just for in your submarine space, but also for the surface fleet with huge construction programs going on.
So you've got all these competing pressures for the industrial and uniformed workforce.
Yes.
And then you've also got, you'll have increasing engineering reports about the fragility and obsolescence of new aspects of the remaining Collins.
So you will just park the Collins and go, all right, everything with every person, every resource we've got now, we're going to put into the nuclear boat. So I see that happening sometime in the mid to late 30s. All this stuff about, well, if we do the low, we can run.
I think it can happen earlier. I think it can happen in the early to mid 2030s. Because the fragility of the Collins fleet is increasing, and already we're organ harvesting the things that support it.
Correct. So it may not even get out to sort of the mid-2030s. So all this talk about, well, if you do the numbers and you map out, you put all six Collins through a life of type extension, the last Collins will be in service until 2048.
Yep.
You are dreaming.
Yep.
That ain't happening. And so that remark that more people are going into the nuclear pipeline shows that that point of no return is coming very quickly.
Look, I'd like to end this podcast on a really happy note, which is I've just seen that the Deputy Prime Minister, Richard Miles, who I think as of this recording is still the Defence Minister.
So I think that is part of his portfolio.
Yeah, I think he still is. I haven't seen that confirmed. But anyway, the Deputy Prime Minister, Richard Miles, he's going to the US and he's going to meet.
Big suitcase in hand, unlike Bill's.
I think that's going to be some of the good news. He's meeting Secretary Hegseth to talk about our shared defence interests and the strength of the alliance going forward. And I think the way he can demonstrate the strength of that is to hand over, I would hope, not just one suitcase full of cash, but maybe two to show the escalating confidence we have in the alliance.
Well, I think you need the one suitcase for the AUKUS industrial base.
Yes.
But I think you need the other suitcase that is at Donald Trump's disposal for him to invest as he sees fit.
I would take that to Secretary Bessent at the Treasury because he's building the mechanism to spend other people's money for non-defence purposes.
Maybe that's
the advantage of the Deputy Prime Minister going, because it would be odd if the Defence Minister took a suitcase full of Aussie cash to the US Treasury Secretary, but for the Deputy Prime Minister to do that. So maybe that's an outcome we will see.
Okay.
I think it's time
We've covered all the big issues. I have to be on a plane to Darwin in an hour or two, so let's wrap it up.
Great to talk with you, Marcus.
You too, Michael.
May this next mission be as successful as your recent two.
Thank you.
Since recording this, we've found out that Richard Miles seems to have made a rookie error or had a horrible tragedy happen. The rookie error was not taking two suitcases full of unmarked bills on his trip to Washington, or the tragedy for him and the Australian taxpayer might be he did take two suitcases full of unmarked bills, but he lost his luggage. And so we had the spectacle of him trying to avoid a meeting with Pete Hegseth because he had no cash to hand over, and Hegseth tracking him down in the White House, only to find that Mr. Miles had no cash to give. He'd turned up empty-handed. We may never know the truth of that debacle.